We're ending the decade by digging into the Fresh Air archives and picking out some interviews from the 80s that we think you'll enjoy. Today we hear from actor and writer Spalding Gray. Gray has influenced the development of theater in the 80s with his comic autobiographical monologues. The monologues have made his private life public, chronicling everything from every bed he slept in during one period of his life to his problems remembering his lines during the making of the film The Killing Fields, in which he had a small part as an American diplomat. But the real subject of Gray's stories are his own neuroses and metaphysical doubts. At the start of the decade, Gray was unknown outside the experimental theater world. Now, at the end of the decade, he's appeared in several films, including Beaches with Bette Midler, David Byrne's True Stories, and the Jonathan Demme-directed film of the monologue Swimming to Cambodia. Gray even had a bad guy part on an episode of Spencer for Hire on TV. His retrospective of monologues was held over at Lincoln Center. He co-starred on Broadway in a revival of Our Town, and he had a book of monologues published called Sex and Death to the Age of 14. The interview we're going to hear was recorded in 1986, when Gray was performing his monologue, The Terrors of Pleasure. In it, he describes how he took a shot at the big time by going to Los Angeles to audition for high-paying TV roles. He needed money to finance a new foundation for the country house he bought, which he just discovered was collapsing. In this part, Gray is describing his screen test for a made-for-TV movie. The director, Simon, and his co-star, Sandy, are both TV veterans. Spalding and Sandy are doing a take of their big love scene.
We were supposed to have just finished making love, and we are now lying naked under the blankets in front of the fire. I am supposed to get out my sketch pad and begin to sketch Dale. Simon put down a paisley spread and asked Sandy and me to get comfortable on it. The honeymoon scene went something like this. Scott, got your eyes full, honey? What are you looking at? Dale, you, Scott. What do you want? Dale, you, Scott. But you've already had me, Dale. Not enough. Never enough. Then I'm supposed to move in on her and sing, a kiss is just a kiss, in her ear, right? And we kiss and collapse in laughter. I really try to find my way into the character. I'm using my notebook as a sketch pad, and I'm holding a paper clip. I'm pretending it's a piece of charcoal. I'm just sketching away as we grow through these lines. All of a sudden, Simon yells, cut, cut, stop, stop, Spalding. The sketch pad is just a prop. Don't worry about it. You really want Dale. And I said, slightly taken aback, because I thought I was in character, oh, you mean I'm not really an artist? Because any artist would rather sketch than make love.
As you may have guessed, Spalding Gray didn't get that part. The role was so unlike what he usually did on stage. I asked him if he had done any roles in the past that had prepared him for the audition.
It was like the kind of scene work I had done in college, where I was thinking of myself then as a young romantic lead. And I was really trying to go back and play this painter that I was supposed to be, and she was supposed to be my model New England painter. And I was very sincere, and I was not bad. I saw the video of it, and the director was supposed to send me the raw video footage, and he freaked. He was afraid that I would do something with it publicly, even though I promised I wouldn't, because he was just afraid of being exposed. But I saw those video playbacks. And a lot of what I did was very dramatic, very intense, but one of the interesting things that I noticed was that my face was totally alive, like amoebic, like protein, all moving and shifting, and my mouth was so expressive, and I'd be touching myself. And I realized that TV people know how to keep a still face so you can project the emotion on them. They are like Zen, in Zen meditation. They don't, and my face was just crawling. And I thought, that would be weird on TV. It wouldn't work. I could understand why when they saw the video.
I'm really not convinced that you could do well on a sitcom.
I don't think I could.
Because you do some of the lines that you had to do readings of,
right,
in your monologue. And those lines are just absurd. They're just so ultra-television. I can't imagine it.
You can't help but taking off on them.
Mm-hmm.
You know? For me, I mean, I couldn't help but doing them ironically. I can't resist that finding the humor in the situation.
So you still, I mean, it looks like you can really do this on your own terms, you know, that you could do acting and movies
pretty much on your own terms. It always works when the directors come to me and not audition me. I'm very bad at auditions. I'm very bad under pressure. It's when the director sees when the director has the vision to see in me what they can use.
Did this hatred of auditions and contribute to your leaving, at least temporarily leaving, acting, stage acting?
Well, I went into the Underground Theater really in 1970 when I joined the performance group. And I would say that probably the audition thing and the whole high-pressure thing and the need to be a part of a group to nurture a way of working, all of those things were playing into it. But as I do say in the monologue, Terrors of Pleasure, I talk about how I would come into, I would always have the fantasy that I was the only actor up for the role. I mean, I knew I wasn't, but it was a fantasy, you know. And you come into that waiting room, and no one knows you from anyone else there when I was just starting out. And you start looking around at these people, and you want to kill these other actors. You know, all of that competition comes up, and then the other side of it is, oh, God, look at that guy. You know, he could do it just as well, or he could do it better, or who am I? You know, what am I bringing special to this situation? And I had to go find my own specialness. And I've taken a long, circuitous route, and I'm ready to come back, and I'm ready to do films. I don't think I'm ready to do plays anymore. Theater, although I occasionally go to it, theater doesn't interest me as much as film.
Why is it?
Because film, for me, is going in and framing the real world. And theater is going into a space that refers to itself. It's a theatrical space. And I worked in theater for so long in the performing garage, in some traditional plays and in a lot of experimental plays. And I called it the windowless art house. What excited me in The Killing Fields was being out in what you would call a normal, relatively normal, natural environment, everyday plays, and watching how it's framed. And made into special time by the film.
Did you ever have the urge to play Hamlet and do Chekhov, mm-hmm. do the great
mm-hmm.
roles?
Mm-hmm. Way back when I was in college, and I acted in every play over 4 years at Emerson College, and I just was sure that was my life was going to be an actor. When I got out, I was going to do. I had done scenes from Hamlet. I was going to act in regional theater. And I wanted to do Chekhov. I wanted to do I had been in a couple of productions of The Seagull. I would have wanted to do Astroff and Uncle Vanya. And now I've lost it. The most recent offer was to play Dr. Dorn for Larry Sacro's production of The Seagull at Birdcliff Theater with Joanne Woodward, who is playing Madame Arkadina. And it was a choice between that and playing my own work at the Goodman Theater, and I went for my own work. And I keep saying I want to get back to the stage. And I said, well, I would play Polonius if it was Spalding Gray in a plaid shirt and dungarees trying to remember Polonius's lines. You see, I have a real battle with lines. I think it's a part of my dyslexia.
Dyslexia?
I have mild dyslexia. And it's not as... I know there are worse cases where you see... where words are just abstract. But if I try to read too fast, the letters begin to bounce around and I'll see saw as was. So I'm a slow reader, dyslexia. And therefore I digest very well. But if I can't do a cold reading in an audition. And even if I have the text in front of me, it bounces around.
It's really hard to believe because I'm not saying I distrust you or anything, but you do your performances so swiftly. I mean, you talk so quickly when you want to.
Yeah.
And you have the whole thing more or less memorized, and it's staggering because it's maybe like a 90-minute or 60-minute monologue.
No,
I know you've got your notes, but
yeah,
you don't really look at them that much.
There's a difference between memorizing. That's an interesting point. I cannot memorize a text that someone else has written and get it right every night. I even with Sam Shepard's Tooth of Crime, the director was always taking notes on that. But I can speak my pieces, which are not memorized, but I'm seeing a film. When I'm telling those stories, I am clearly seeing the film of those stories. So I'm really describing what's coming into my mind. If it had to be memorized, I couldn't do it.
Right, so you don't have to get it word for word, and no one's got to follow, get their cue from you.
Well, that's it. The pressure's not on me. I don't function well under pressure. That's part of why I'm not out there grabbing the big film roles.
In fleshing out your on-stage Spalding Gray character, has that brought you in touch with different parts of yourself that were maybe not very developed before?
The humor, definitely. I really got my sense of humor when I came to New York City. And that was a combination of, you've got to laugh to be in that place. And the other was being exposed to Judaism on a large scale like that. And finally having a Jewish girlfriend.
Oh.
No, that wasn't funny. They have a great sense of humor. And they're very extroverted. And I had grown up with introverted WASPs who have this very dry sense of humor, which is a sense of humor. I'm not saying that it's not there. But there was a certain broadness that I discovered through being in New York and being exposed to that in people. And so there's that. And the other thing that I have been able to do is to travel and to be alone now that I'm a writer, or now that I know that it can be material. And before, I really used to disappear a lot, just feeling very anxious about being in a place where no one recognized me. And since I've been learned how to take notes, there's an aspect of me, the writer, that recognizes the person, Spalding Gray. There's a very clear schism now, where I'm always watching my life for experiences that can be used, and sometimes creating the experiences, which I make a joke about in the monologue, where I say, "Oh, did I buy this house in order to make this monologue? Because now it's come full circle." I was in Cambridge performing last year. And a woman who's reviewing a very academic book on postmodern theater, she said, "You know, I thought I couldn't include you in my book. And now I've seen your monologue about the house, and I now know that you're a postmodernist writer in this sense." And she had this all theoretical, right? There's some a French semiotic philosopher who says that the sign of postmodernism is that the act, the map of the act exists before the event. He uses nuclear war as an example to say that we know where the nuclear war is going to be fought. It's all on computer. And this is a postmodern condition. And she said, "You bought that house in order to make the monologue. Therefore, you're a postmodernist." And now you can be in my book.
So you're going to be in it. So does this mean that before you came to New York, you were a very kind of like serious artist, that you didn't, you weren't funny?
Yeah. No sense of humor at all. No sense of humor. In fact, I can remember an old girlfriend that I had. She had been a girlfriend at Emerson College, and then she came to visit me in New York after I'd been living there for about 2 years. And a bunch of us were sitting around, and she was just seeing me for the first time in a long time. And afterwards, she said, "I didn't know you were funny. You were funny. You were making me laugh. You were never funny when I knew you. What happened?" No, that was really heavy. Really. Oh, God. When I was at Emerson College, I would go to sleep at 10 o'clock every night listening to Dylan Thomas read Fernhill. That would be my tranquilizer.
I mean, how do you get to be funny? I understand what exposed you to humor and everything, but I always think of humor as being something you're either, you know, born with or not, in a way. It's not something that you can... The deadliest people are the people who decide, "Well, I think I ought to add a little humor to my life."
You know, I think it was there with me, and I think it went underground when... it was there with me in high school. I was a real clown, cutting up a lot, blah, 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 but I think it went underground during that heavy puberty time, and it was just, I turned into this really kind of existentially death-obsessed poet in college with just morbid.
Was that really good for getting girls, by the way?
No, it wasn't.
It wasn't, really?
No. I was really, truly disturbed. I didn't have many girlfriends in college, not until my senior year. No, I was into suffering. I was really into suffering, and I lived in an alley. Because I took the cheapest apartment I could find, you know, to help my father out, and I was working as the janitor there, and it was $35 a month because I was emptying trash, and this alley was filled with rats in Boston because they have these, and you could only enter into the apartment from the alley. We called it Rat Alley, and no one would come to visit me. You can imagine a girl coming there in any hour. Well, at night, I'd have to come home clapping my hands. Then the rats would scurry out of the way. No kidding. I was like Edgar Allan Poe, morbid. And, you know, I had to enter into my apartment directly from the street, which meant there was no entranceway. A rat could have scurried right in there. So I didn't have any girlfriends, freshman, sophomore. I mean, it was Emerson College. Most of them were Jewish women up from New York who were into musical comedy and laughs. I mean, I was playing the wrong role. If I had been at Harvard and was acting that way, maybe it would have been different.
You know, one of the things that you really use your humor for so well is describing your own neuroses, which happens to be similar to neuroses that a lot of us have. And it makes it seem, it's, you know, it's so effortless and everything when you're on stage, and it makes it seem like, wow, neuroses aren't that bad. They're really pretty funny. And in fact, they're not funny to have them at all. It's funny to describe them when you're funny at it.
Mm.
But do your like problems ever strike you as being funny at the time?
No, they don't. It's not an overly painful situation, but it's an annoying situation because it's a repeat of... It gets boring because it's a repeat. The same neuroses keep coming back, and you get bored with it, and you think, now, wait a minute. Can I... You know, there's going to be a point where I just can't turn these into monologues any longer. Oh, maybe you can. Woody Allen's able to do one a year, you know, a film a year. I should be able to do a monologue a year if you have enough variety and setting and change it. But I think, you know, for instance, one of my problems is like taking a vacation, the neurosis about the vacation, and being able to just unwind and do nothing. And I did a little journalism in Australia and earned some extra money and decided I had always wanted to go to Bali, and I was going to go there and I was going to relax. And I got there and I started freaking out the first couple of days I was there. And then three people recognized me on the street of Ubud when I was in the art center. And so they were kind of leading me into this art community there. And I was starting to touch down, you know, finding myself in the landscape. And I got relaxed after about 5 days. And I said, now I'm going to go a little bit further. I saw all these people on motorcycles, you know. I said, I am going to rent a motorcycle and take a trip, a pleasurable trip up to this beautiful beach on the East Coast. Now I'm going to go a little bit further, and I got real nervous about all of this. I mean, it was a chaotic day, you know, because I could feel the neurosis coming on. And to avoid drinking a lot, I'd been going a cocktail hour. Every cocktail hour, I go to a Balinese healer, a Balian, who is the most wonderful man who was laughing all the time at me. He thought, because originally I went there and told him I was in three places at once, and he said he had never had anyone come in with that disease. Maybe I should get a shot, you know, of something. He wanted to send me away. Then he got out these magical drawings that his grandfather had done, pencil drawings, and we went through it to try to find a drawing that would fit my condition. So we get out this beautiful drawing of this guy with no head and four legs, and his eyes are in his chest. So the healer does a mantra about that, you know, and does a copy of it for me. He copies it, and I have to have this picture over my bed. Then I told him that I thought part of why I couldn't take a vacation, why I was so riled up, was because my mother committed suicide when I was taking a vacation in Mexico, you know, in the summer, and that this is coming back on me. It was kind of Freudian theory. Oh, yes, he understood this. Now, he spoke very little English, but he understood what I was saying. And he did a whole ceremony for my mother's spirit, and we picked out a drawing for her, and he was going to lay her spirit to rest. His wife made an offering and the whole thing, you know, and he did a mantra. It was very powerful for me, and then I ate the offering, and I thought, now, I've got a drawing that says total protection. My mother's spirit is laid to rest. I'm going to take this motorcycle, you know, up to this beach, and I'm going to have a good time, right? And he told me the day to travel on. By the way, he got down the Balinese calendar. Now, it took me so long to get the motorcycle together and to get everything going that I could tell night was coming on. It was a two-hour trip up to this beach. And I thought, now maybe I should travel tomorrow when I'm fresh, you know? And he said, no, he said it was a bad day to travel tomorrow. I've got to go today. So I'm off, and it's a great trip, and everything is fine, but night falls in those countries near the equator, like whoosh, just there. And it's been 98 degrees, and all of a sudden it's night, and I'm riding in a kind of damp t-shirt and shorts on this motorcycle, and I can feel this cold coming on. I mean, it came on within a minute, you know, and I ended up with this unbelievable head cold on this most idyllic beach, you know. So I knew it was subconscious. I couldn't even get a hold of that. You know, that was the angering part. I had everything consciously worked out, you know. Oh, God, that was so... I lay on that beach so depressed, and it was so idyllic, and it was so beautiful. Of course, beauty terrifies me.
You'll never be that prepared for a vacation again.
I know, everything. I mean, exactly. It was, everything was pointed toward ecstasy. Everything.
So what's holding you back from letting go and enjoying yourself?
We don't know, do we? Because that unconscious let the cold in. Imagine catching a cold in Bali, come on. 98 degrees, a head cold. It's like a nightmare. Feel like you have a fever all the time.
One of the things that's held together a lot of your monologues is an obsession with the perfect moment, with finding the perfect moment. Where does that come from? When did you first start wanting the perfect moment?
See, I always wanted it and didn't know. I didn't have a name for it. In fact, both my older brother and I both have had cravings for that, particularly Rocky, my older brother. And I don't know what it came from. Something to do with the relationship to my mother, who was constantly questing for ecstatic states. She was very concerned with that. And I've always been concerned with all mood changes, my ally is alcohol. That produces the mood change that I feel best with, and I have to be very careful with it because it's an ally. I don't want it to work against me. When I first conceived of the word was reading, when I first adopted the word, was reading a book on Sartre, Sartre's works. It was an analysis of nausea, and they kept referring to Sartre's idea of the perfect moment being the bourgeois concept of when the bourgeois or ego gets in a place where everything seems to revolve around it is the perfect moment, when raw, indifferent nature coincides with the human ego. And the imperfect moment could also be a perfect moment. I mean, to lose that ego, which I've also experienced, and that is another perfect moment. But usually it's when all the elements agree with you.
Have you had any?
And have I? Oh, yeah. I talk about it in Swimming to Cambodia in the Indian Ocean. When I was doing Killing Fields, when I dismelted with the ocean, it was very beautiful. I've had some near-perfect ones in Australia, but, my brother Rocky is looking for them, and I can remember he married late, and his wife is one of those really, she had been married before, really down-to-earth Jewish mother types, and he came home from, he teaches at a boys' school, and he came home one day and went, "Oh, God, I haven't had an ecstatic moment in days." And she said, "What? What did you say? An ecstatic moment? How many of those do you expect to have in a lifetime?" She just laid into him, And the two of us are always going around like that, just dreaming, like, when's it going to come next? I don't know what that has to do with. It's some sort of two-year-old consciousness.
Actor and writer Spalding Gray, as recorded in 1986.